This is Jerry Groobs, April 21st, 2006, entitled Children and Jung.
I worked at the Child Sexual Abuse Treatment Program in Santa Clara County, California. And it was there where I started working with children and was introduced to sand clay therapy. I was very deeply moved by the process that I saw these children doing in sand and the way they would express the archetypes and the symbols and how they related to, in that particular world as if it were so natural to them. And I was very fascinated in how it seemed to guide the healing process. So I mentioned to a friend at lunch, I was thinking ahead about what kind of a therapist I wanted to be and all, and I said, what I really want to do more than anything is bring together children and Jung, children-child therapy with a Jungian perspective. Well, little did I know at the time that this actually had been evolving since the time Jung started developing his theories of the unconscious in the early 1920s. And I think few of us Jungians are really not even fully aware of that. It started with Frances Wicks with her book that came out in 1927 on the inner world of childhood, which was a top seller at the time. And she was very much Jungian. And then there was Eric Neumann and Michael Fordham and Dora Koff, all of whom I'm going to be talking about today and how they developed their theories and how their theories influence analytical psychology with children today. Now, C.G. Jung is well known for and certainly specialized in the individuation process of midlife adults. That was his focus, and that's what he was known for, and with no focus on children. But still, Jung was quite aware of the collective unconscious in children and the role of fantasy with children, the archetypes and ego development in these young people. He actually wrote several articles that are in the collected works. One is on the gifted child, and the other is on the development of personality, which is both in the collected works 17, along with other articles on children. And Jung occasionally held seminars on children's dreams, and he saw positive value in their fantasy play and even encouraged some of his analysts, particularly Dora Koff, to work with children. Now, I want to read to you a little paragraph that Jung wrote in the introduction to Frances Wicks' book, The Inner World of Childhood. Now, this is Jung. The child's psyche, prior to the stage of ego consciousness, is very far from being empty and devoid of content. Scarcely has speech developed when, in next to no time, consciousness is present. And this, with its momentary contents and its memories, exercises an intensive check upon the previous collective contents. That such contents exist in a child who has not yet attained to ego consciousness is a well-attested fact. The most important evidence in this respect is the dreams of 3- and 4-year-old children, among which there are some so strikingly mythological and so fraught with meaning that one would take them at once for the dreams of grown-ups, did not one know who the dreamer was. Because of its universal distribution, the collective psyche, which is still so close to the small child, perceives not only the background of the parents, but ranging further afield, the depths of good and evil in the human soul. So I'm going to present the 4 analysts that pretty much made child analytical psychology what it is today. And I'm actually going to show you some pictures of them as I talk. We might have to darken the room a little bit, do you think? Or? I wonder if that'll... Let's see. Can you see that okay? Good, and then that gives me enough light, too, for my notes. Now, Frances Wicks, she's the first who dates back to the 1920s. And Frances Wicks wrote the book, The Inner World of Childhood. And like I says, it was the number one bestseller in 1927. And it's still around today. I checked on the Amazon.com to see if her book was still there. And not only is it still around when most books are out of print, but it sells enough copies to be on the, you know, fairly low-numbered rank that they rank their books on Amazon.com. She was not a trained psychologist. She was actually what they called a lay analyst, and I'm not exactly sure what that means. Probably an analyst that wasn't trained psychologically. And she was a school teacher. And that's how she gained her knowledge of children, was primarily as a school teacher when she worked with or observed children with their families and how the parents influenced the children and how the children influenced them. So the major focus of her book was on the environmental influences on the child, with the premise that the parental system influences the child more than anything else. She quotes, "We do not attach sufficient importance to the psychic bond, which in early childhood often amounts to a condition of identity of the unconscious of the child with the unconscious of the parents." So this unconscious identification is often referred to as participation mystique. And what she was saying is their unconscious is very much together, so that one is influencing the other on an unconscious level, so consciously they aren't even aware of it. I've heard cases where children will actually have dreams of the parents. They will have the parents' dreams if the parent isn't aware of the conflict that's going on in her life and isn't having the dreams. Sometimes the child will have the parents' dreams. And Jung believed that as well about the unconscious. And they both believe that, so if you bring in a troubled child, all you need to do, or what you need to do most, is to work with the parents. You work with the parents, and then the child gets better. Now, this theory has been refuted through the years, especially by Michael Fordham, and I'll go into that. But I think that's something that we need to take into consideration, that, there is an unconscious influence, and that's why it's so important to work with the parents while you're seeing a child, or at least see them regularly. And actually, a case comes to mind that I worked with that really clarified to me how important you do need to take into consideration the parents' issues. There was a mother who brought her two boys to me who were depressed, and one of them was actually had some suicidal ideation and acting out behavior. And as I worked with the boys, I started to develop a relationship with the mother. And then she came in to see me once a week, too. And what I found from her was that she had lost her mother. Her mother had died when she was 15 years old, and was very isolated with her grief. Her father didn't mention her mother's name anymore after her death. He was very cold. He was very distant from her, and she was very alone with her grief. So here she was in her 30s, and she had these two boys, and the boys were grieving the same. They were grieving for her, not even knowing what it was they were grieving, but I saw it in their sand trays. A lot of their sand trays actually had images. They selected skeletons to put in their sand trays. When she did a sand tray, she used the same skeleton that they did. So it was very interesting. I'm sure sand play therapists would see this quite often when they work with families. Because there really is a familial archetypal pattern that you see expressed in the sand trays from one member of the family to the next. And not only is there an archetypal pattern, there's also the cultural pattern you see expressed in the sand tray, as well as racial, sexual, ancestral. So all need to be considered when working with children and need to be addressed. Okay, so that was the main premise of Francis Wick's in the 1920s, and the focus of Jung at the time, too. And then there's, do you know who that is? That's Eric Neumann. He's probably very well known, not so much, he is well known, but not so much as a child analyst, although he did write a book called Child. He was actually a philosopher and psychiatrist, and he's considered one of Jung's most gifted students. He and his wife both studied with Carl Jung. Eric Neumann had his deepest roots in the Jewish tradition, and he was most drawn to the mystical side of Judaism. If you've read any of his works, they're quite mystical and very deep and powerful readings. Dr. Neumann formulated his theories of child development from supervisory sessions that he had with a group of child therapists. And they met regularly, probably once a month, for about 10 years. And it was through these meetings that he developed his theories on child development from a mythical point of view. Then he wrote his, he never actually worked with children himself. He worked with adults. So his book on the child was published in 1963 in German, and then it was translated into English in 1973. He's most known for his classic work, The Origins and History of Consciousness. Neumann based his theories of personality development on archetypal themes rather than on psychoanalysis. So in his book, The Child, he demonstrates how the development of the child's ego consciousness recapitulates the same archetypal stages and symbolic images that appear in ancient mythologies. Now, similar to Francis Wick's, Eric Neumann felt that there was a very powerful mother-child unity. And he took it even further than Francis Wick's by saying that the infant, during the first year of its life, was actually the infant's psyche, the infant's ego, and even the self, is contained within the mother's psychic system. That this infant was pretty much a blank slate, nothing, and the mother had to hold and contain the psychic contents of the child. And he called this first stage the Ouroboric stage, which is the image of the snake biting its tail. Eric Neumann states, the infant is totally embedded in this realm, in the Ouroboric realm, in which the mother represents for it both world and self. Now, Dora Kauf was the one who found the most use of Eric Neumann's theories. Because as she analyzed Santres of children, she saw that a lot of his theories, that his theories were actually being created in the sand play process. So she was very deeply moved by him. And she particularly saw the ego stages of ego development in the sand play process. And what she called them, and what Eric Neumann called them, was the animal vegetative stage. That's where the ego expresses itself in pictures that are primarily animal and vegetation. Then there's the fighting stage, where battles appear again and again. And this happens a lot in latency age children and puberty, especially with boys, you know, where they do the fighting over and over. And then there's the adaptation to the collective. And all of these follow Neumann's theories on the development of the ego. What she wanted to do was work closely with Neumann and on his theories and see how they were portrayed in the sand play process. And they had talked about getting together and working on this, but unfortunately he passed away before they had a chance to do that. He died prematurely in 1960 of kidney cancer, I believe. So, it's my sense that Eric Neumann's theories are best seen in creative expressions. I think when you look at drawings and sand play, you can see how they're portrayed in these pictures. And that's a lot easier to grasp. Okay. Now that's Dorokoff. Pardon?
Dorokoff.
Dorokoff, the founder of sand play. She was actually a friend of Carl Jung's. Her children played with his grandchildren, and it was Carl Jung's daughter that introduced Dorokoff to Carl Jung. And they developed a good relationship, and he encouraged her to study at the Jung Institute. She did not have a degree at the time. She was a pianist and a musician, didn't have a bachelor's degree, but she was accepted in the institute, and she studied there for 6 years. And then when it came time for her certification, they wouldn't give it to her because she didn't have her degree. So Jung knew how well she was, how closely she worked with children, how good she was with children. He encouraged her to pursue working with children. And it was about that time she went to England to a conference by Margaret Loewenfeld, who had been, she had just come up with a new technique where she would have children set aside a bunch of miniature figures in a sand tray, and children would play out their problems in the tray of sand. Well, she called this the whirl technique, and this was a big thing that was going on in the 1930s, 40s, especially in 1940s. Actually, maybe it was about 1940 when this was developed. And Mrs. Koff was very touched by this, and she decided to go and study there in England with Margaret Loewenfeld and also Donald Winnicott. And she was there for a couple of years, took the information from that she learned there, came back to Switzerland, lived in a little town near Zurich called Solothurn, and applied the theories of Jung to what she saw expressed in this new sand technique, this whirl technique. And she gave it a new name because she extended upon it. I wouldn't say she changed it. She just added more to it because she saw a whole process that happened in the sand, especially when you make one tray after the next. She saw how there was a continuity within the trays and how the process would go to the deeper and deeper, deeper levels of the psyche, according to Jung's theories. And she saw the archetypes being expressed in it. This wasn't a focus with Margaret Loewenfeld's whirl technique. Sand play was officially launched in 1957. Now, there's probably a lot of you that don't even know what sand play is or what it looks like, but this is a sand play room, and what you need in sand play, as you can see, are hundreds and hundreds of miniature figures, items from nature, everything you can think of, buildings, trees, communities, religious, evil, anything and everything you have available for the person to create whatever they want to create in the tray of sand. Now you see two trays there. One is kept dry, and the other can be wetted. And the wetting process is quite important, especially with children. Sometimes they'll flood the trays. And so the next person comes in, you know, and wants to do their little dry tray, and there's just one flooded tray and it doesn't work. So you have to have two trays for that reason. And you can see all the variety of different kinds of figures.
Are the figures deliberately archetypal?
No. But there are a lot of archetypes, aren't there? Now, these are knights and soldiers. Children, especially boys, really use those a lot. Well, with the higher shelves, they'll point them out, or I also have a step, you know, and they can stand up to it. Sometimes with the real little ones, I'll just actually lift them right up, you know, if they want to see something or point it out.
What do you tell them to do?
Make whatever they want. Actually, with children, you don't really have to say much. Yeah, they just do. You know, it's natural for them. Actually, children were the ones who invented the technique. Because Margaret Lowenfeld said she just happened to have these miniature figures here, and she happened to have a tray of sand over there. I think maybe even she had a tray of water. And the children started putting the figures in the sand. So the children are the ones who actually invented the technique. They were communicating to her what they needed. To work through their process.
Why not on the floor?
What, the tray of sand? It can. You can put the tray on the floor. Well, you know, you need to have the figures organized, because if you just have them all in one pile, you can't really see them. Now, adults do sand play too, not only children, and I'll go into that a little bit more later. Actually, right now, I'm working even more with adults, and I have adults do sand play quite regularly. But you need to have that there, because it grabs your attention, and you've got to have it organized. Plus, for cleaning up the tray, you need to put things, you want to know where to put them, so it's good to have them categorized. It makes it easier for cleanup and all of that. Yeah. Oh, why in the sand? Well, you know, the sand is kind of a, you can think of it as Mother Earth. It's really the mother, and it also has depth to it. And in the sand, in the tray, the bottom of it, the inside of the tray is blue. And they can spread the sand out to have water there. They can wet it down. They can mold it. They can shape it. They can make connections. You can do so much more in the sand. Plus, it's like having your hands in Mother. Yeah, there's just a much greater power to it. Goes to the deepest of depths, as Dorokoff would often say. So sand play is a process that can touch the depths of the soul. The process itself can continue uninterrupted for years, with trays being created as often as the child or the adult needs to do or desires to do. In the process itself, there's an evolutionary pattern expressed by the creator. The first trays generally tend to be more community-oriented, everyday-oriented, the real-world-oriented. And as they make the trays, they go deeper and deeper into the unconscious. And various things become worked out. What you start seeing is possibly a tension of opposites. And so there's a kind of a tension that's created in the sand. And then you might see the opposites start coming together in some way through the process as it moves along from one tray to the next. And then the real powerful moment or divine moment is when they actually create an image of the self. And that would be a mandala. Generally, it's a mandala. It could also be a square or a rectangle in the center of the tray. They tend to be very simple, although it's different from one person to the next. But you know when a self tray has been made. Pardon?
Would the production of a mandala have a long period of time playing the sand player?
It's different for each person. You know, it could happen fairly early in the process, or maybe it won't happen for years. But the important thing is it needs to be spontaneous and not actually planned by the person. It's just spontaneously made.
This is an example of a... is that clear? No, here, I think I can... there we go. This is a self tray that was made by a 11-year-old girl, quite spiritually evolved 11-year-old. She wasn't seeing me for therapy. She was in my research, my dissertation research on sexually abused children compared with the sand play of non-clinical children. She was one of the non-clinical girls. She was actually the child of a woman in the doctoral program with me, a student. She made actually two self trays. Made this one and then another tray, and then she had another self tray after that. And I'm actually going to be presenting her full process in the class. She's the spiritually evolved. Her tray was quite powerful and very deeply moving. But this is an example of a self tray. You can see it's a mandala. In the center is a treasure chest. This is a sign, do not touch. Don't, you know, and then here's a Bible. And then there's a couple of lambs and eggs. And then you have to have the dark side there too, because you have the opposites in the self. And there's a little monkey, a black monkey. And when she made that, she just called this a treasure island. She says, and nobody should touch the treasure island.
Nobody should touch it.
It's very old.
Why is there a bridge to it?
Yeah, there's a bridge to it. That's, you know, she felt safe in her environment. She was able to have her inner self accessible to the environment. And I think she, to me, it communicates that she knew that whoever came near that island would respect it. And maybe she would invite them there, you know, and they would come and they would respect it. We didn't talk a whole lot about that tray. Usually self-trays, you don't. Sometimes you're just so awed by when these trays are made that you just sit and just hold it. Both of you hold it. This here is an example of some of what This, what you can see here, this is a side angle, and that is a strip of light that's on the film, and that was the only strip of light on that whole roll of film when I took that picture. And that's happened before at conferences. I've seen that. You know, you don't see it all the time, but it's not surprising when you see that. It's like, oh, okay, yeah. I know, it's got a lot of aura to it, that bright light. Dorokoff says, the inner order, this pattern of wholeness, is the most important movement in the development of the personality. Psychotherapeutic work has proven that healthy development of the ego can take place only as a result of the successful manifestation of the self. The self may manifest as a dream symbol or as a depiction in a sandbox. Such a manifestation of the self seems to guarantee the development and consolidation of the personality. So you can have a dream of this inner self and maybe not even know about it. And then that could be a consolidation of your personality. But she believes that that needs to be touched in some way within your psyche. And then after they make the self tray, then the next trays tend to be more, they start flowing more to the outer level. Actually, what Koff noted was that they go into the stages of ego development, which Eric Neumann theorized. There's the animal vegetative scene, and then there's kind of a fighting stage, and or they go directly to the collective level, you know, return to the community after that. And when you see a return, you see it expressed slightly different from the way the earlier trays were expressed. Something has shifted in that place where they went to that level, something externally has shifted for them. Maybe something that was previously separated, something that was kept distant, has come together in the trays after a self-tray is made. Now, when they do a sand tray, interpretation by the therapist is delayed. The therapist doesn't interpret to the child. That stops the process. What we do is honor and contain the self to guide the healing process. So we don't want to intrude, and we don't guide and direct. The therapist pretty much observes, is the witness, and lets the child communicate what's happening in the sand, kind of on a symbolic level, like telling a story or a fairy tale. Now, sand play is a process that's equally beneficial for adults as well as for children. Adults tend to hold back a little bit. They don't get involved in the sand quite as easily as children, unless they've got a real ability to play. You know, an adult has a real ability to do that. It helps their healing. It helps their therapy, their analysis, when they do sand trays regularly. Dora Kauf quoted often, "A human being is only complete when at play." And Carl Jung, it's a story told, and if you've read his Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, about how when he had his break with Freud, how he spent days and months playing on the shores of Lake Zurich, building canals and connecting, and he would, for hours, he would be playing there, and he was really doing sand play. And this was long before sand play, you know, before anybody knew about it. Now, because of Mrs. Kauf's ability to speak many languages, she was able to bring sand play in a very personal way to Europe, to North America, and to Japan. And today, it's actually the main therapeutic modality in Japan, sand play. Kauf's lectures are what have made sand play well known in our clinics and practices today. Now, the last one I'm going to talk about is probably the most influential analyst for child analytical psychology, and that's Michael Fordham. Michael Fordham was a child psychiatrist, so he did work with children, as did Dora Kauf. And he became a Jungian analyst in the 1950s, I believe. He's considered one of the most creative first-generation analysts after Jung. And he was the first analyst that actually brought Jungian theories and Freudian theories together, primarily from his interest and work with Melanie Klein, who was developing her theories of the fantasy play of children about the same time that Jung was developing his theories on the archetypes. And he thought that Melanie Klein was really more Jungian than Freudian because of these theories that she saw similar things that children were expressing that Jung was seeing expressed with adults. Melanie Klein wrote extensively on the unconscious fantasy life in small children at the same time that Jung was developing his theories of archetypes, which I've said. Her work was central to Fordham's study of early childhood and infant behavior patterns, as well as his use of transference, counter-transference. He's very well known for his use of transference with children. And he wrote extensively on that. Fordham also used his theories and developed infant observation with children. And he just by his observations of this infant-mother relationship, that went on for years and years and years and actually is still going on today. He developed most of his theories from this. He actually, in his observations, he saw that there was actually an ego structure or some rudimentary kind of ego structure in as early as infancy, and that the infant certainly had a sense of self. And that there were even times when the infant was even stronger than the mother. If the mother was depressed, was not available, some infants were able to actually get the mother to pay attention to them. And so that's where he refuted the theory that Neumann said the infant didn't have anything and it was all contained within the mother. Erich Neumann developed a theory of ego development that I find quite important, because I see this theory expressed often not only in ego development but ego transformation later on within adults. And he called this deintegration, reintegration process. And I'm going to explain to you this deintegration, reintegration process. He first noted that in infancy, when the infant would feed at the mother's breast, it would become kind of agitated or activated in certain times. And then at other times, the infant would be more passive, introverted, and would retreat. And so he speculated that it was during these times that the infant was feeding at the mother's breast that the self, capital S, the essence of the infant, became activated. And he referred to that as deintegration. Fordham states, in order to come into relation with its environment, this deintegration must occur. So as an image, its deintegration is a putting out into the environment and acting out, and reintegration is a bringing in within the psyche. And the bringing in begins to develop the ego. He saw this process happen in a more intense way between the ages of 1 and 2, which is the separation individuation phase of development, according to Winnicott. Now, as I said, I'm real drawn to this to his theory, because I do see it expressed especially the Sampley process of both adults and children, when an ego has already been formed, that some breaking down occurs and then a quieting or a recentering is expressed later, and maybe even generally it happens, the breaking down in one santre, the chaos, and then the reintegration the next santre. Just pretty much back to back. I'm going to show you, I put together some diagrams which will kind of give you a sense of what it is that he developed and what I see. So this is, if you can imagine that this is the infant's psyche when the infant is born. And this big orange, the golden circle, is the original self. That's the essence of this infant. And the little green thing, dots, that's the undeveloped ego. That's the potential, the ego potential of this infant. It's like the cosmic egg and myths. What gives birth to all things and in itself contains all things. This essence, the self, contains the unique code of the child. Now, infant observation shows that infants do indeed have an ego, although it's instinctual and perhaps archetypal. So it isn't fully acted out in the world. The potential is there. And then about a year of age, 12, 18 months, the deintegration starts happening in a very powerful way. And so I express that as, you know, the self activating. It's becoming active. It's a gradual and spontaneous activation of the self to become conscious in the outer world. It's similar to a quote from an ancient text. From the cosmic egg springs Eros. He revealed and brought to light everything that had been previously lain hidden in the golden egg. Deintegration is a readiness of experience, a readiness to perceive and act. And the deintegrates are aspects of the self. They're the archetypes. They're aspects, and they're activated out into the environment. And during this phase, the child acts according to the pattern of these deintegrates of the self. The child tends to be more chaotic, unmanageable, expressing his real sense of self. And I think we all know that, you know, with children, it's the terrible twos. You can't control them, you can't contain them. And it's what sometimes called toddler glee. You know, they're just all over the place. And then it's followed by, it might be like this for 2 or 3 days or so. And then there'll be about 2 or 3 days of calm where the child starts integrating or settles down, becomes calm. And that is the phase of integration. Now, deintegration energizes the child to realize who he or she is, and it develops develops and strengthens the ego. Now, it's important to note that deintegration is not disintegration. Disintegration is a fragmentation of the ego. Deintegration is an activation of the self that builds the ego, it strengthens the ego. So then there's deintegration, and then how the environment responds to this deintegration. You know, some parents could be hold and contain it, they could allow the child to express its exuberant self, mirror back in a certain way, and that is brought back into the psyche and begins to develop the ego. But not only is the mirroring of the external world brought back, also the archetypal energy that comes from the self is also brought back in the developing ego. So I've got those little bubbles there as the developing ego. And of course, maybe complexes will start forming about that time. So you have those little squiggly things on there, the complexes. You see those little squiggly things there? That and that. Those are the little developing complexes. So integration can be observed most when the individual is alone. It seems to require a temporary isolation from its environment. You might see the child suddenly curl up and suck its thumb. You know, that from acting out in an intense way to a day later, there they are curled up sucking their thumb. You know, this is all part of the development of the ego. They, you know, they need to go through this in order for that to come about. Then around age 3 or so, suddenly the child starts referring to him or herself in the third person, or the first person, as I. Before that, it was the third person. They would talk about themselves kind of as if they were somebody else. But suddenly they start saying, I. My grandson, suddenly when he was close to 3, was also learning how to run, and I was coming home, and here he was running towards me. I'm running, Grandma. Look, I'm running. It's the first time he had said I, and it was just very touching for me. His ego was there. He knew that he was an I. I am that I am. I am that which comes forth from me. And then about this time, too, there's their ability to relate to symbols. They start making circles in their drawings. and it's their person drawing is what they do. They call that a person. And that's the mandala. That's the relationship between the ego and the self, which shows that the ego has been formed about that time. Now that comes from Michael Fordham's book. That is deintegration. This is a 7-year-old child that came to him. And he titled it The Rain of Tears. It's actually it's the boat in the storm drawing. I'm going to be doing that imagery in the class. But you can see the chaos, the deintegration. It's all over the place. It's, you know, a spattering of dots and chaos, and it even could be the dark night of the storm. You know, if it were in black, it could be called the dark night of the storm. And then this is an example of reintegration. It's a mandala. It has rootedness. It's called the rooted phalli. By the same child, I think a few months later. And mandalas, again, they can be squares, triangles. It's the integrative phase. And that mandala is an image of the ego in relationship to the self. And we're going to go into that in the class. I'm going to spend some time talking about the mandala and what the boundary of the mandala means and when the mandala expresses perils of the soul, which is within us, and bring that forth out into the world. Oftentimes we get distant from it, you know, and then we lose contact with it. And in midlife we want to return to it. And in order to return to it, oftentimes we have to give up the primacy of the ego to return back to the self. In the first part of life, you want to develop the ego and make that primary. In the second phase of life, you make the self primary, and the ego, you know, it isn't so important anymore.
When you speak of the ego self axis, you're talking about the integration of the ego centrally in the self?
It's a connection. It's a connection. I'm sure there isn't any kind of physical cord or anything that does it, but if we can imagine that there is this imaginary connection between the ego and the self. That would be called the ego self axis. So deintegration, reintegration, I noticed occurs, you know, here the ego is formed, it's gone through this process, and then later on in life, deintegration, reintegration can happen again, especially when the ego is needing to change, when it's needing to transform. This similar process I see. And I don't know if Fordham has ever written about this, but I see this happening again later on in adult life. But it's slightly different. It's a slightly different process than at the beginning, because at the beginning it's a formation of the ego. In the end, it's a transformation of the ego. And so this might be what it looks like. This would usually occur during periods of adolescence. You know, they go through a real upheaval, an activation, you know, of the self. It's a wild period. During major life transitions or traumas, a crisis in one's life, it can activate the deintegration, reintegration process. When the healing process is activated, when you enter analysis or when you do sand play, or if you have a spiritual upheaval in your life, kundalini, there's this activation, and I think the self again activates and probably creates a deintegration of the ego as well, and then the energy is brought back, and it's something has shifted in the ego. The ego identity. Or maybe the ego is breaking down for the primacy of the self. And then again, what the environment mirrors back, the kind of environment that you're in will be an aspect of what's reintegrated back into the ego. So you can see major transformations happening during this time. I've actually seen deintegration, reintegration happen in one sand play session with adults, where the adult will go to the sand and stir it up, maybe have intense emotion, intense feelings, and stir up the sand, and you know, can go on for a long period like that, and then gradually start moving the sand and centering and centering. You know, the deintegration and then the recentering, reintegration. It can even happen in the transference relationship, where they go through what Fordham refers to as a neurotic neurotic transference onto the analyst, where they're very angry at the analyst. The analyst doesn't do what you want. It's like you're experiencing your parents again. You can be angry for session after session, and then suddenly something shifts, and you come back, and you see something new. You see something has shifted in your relationship with the analyst and your relationship to other people in your life. And that's, I believe, deintegration, reintegration. Sand play again. This is deintegration. This is a tray by a 9-year-old girl. She was sexually abused. And in this chaos, she was sexually abused by someone in the church. So she has nuns here, and she has a priest here. But then there's the reptiles, a giant spider, frog with a baby in its mouth. Deintegration, sometimes I call these wound trays. Deintegration can be a release, an eruption of the wounding that they suffered. The next tray, the same girl, the very next tray, reintegration. She appropriately called it the new system. And it could be animal vegetative, but not really, because you've got the collective there and you've got some people there. But here's a waterfall that she drew. Doesn't look like the tray of the same child. Pardon? Very next week. Yeah. This is deintegration. A 10-year-old boy who was sexually abused. He called this the rising of the woken one. A giant spider has just risen up, he said. And then you've got reptiles around. I would call this tray the perils of the soul, because it's actually in a mandala shape, too. A very wet, very primal. He's expressing something very deep that he has suffered. And that's his next tray. Reintegration. That's an animal vegetative tray. Trees, and all of these are animals. Pandas, cuddly bears. His earlier trays had a lot of evil in them. Something really shifted when he went to that level. It's an adult male. The eruption of this primal contents came to the surface. And his next tray, reintegration, with some bridging possibilities here, and he's got the frog prints in the center of the tray. Symbol of transformation. There's a potential transformation that's happened for him. Okay, that's it for the slides. And I think what we'll do now, let's take a 10-15 minute break. In conceptual basis of child analytical psychology is that there is a central core to every human life, including infants, and that it not only needs but demands sufficient space for development. So the focus of child analysis is on that core. And that's not really a whole lot different from adult analysis, you know, when we think about it. Children just touch that core differently than adults tend to touch. So the aim is to provide for an experience of the self in the form of archetypal images and energy, which relieves stress and develops the ego, develops and strengthens it. Now, the rapport with the therapist, fantasy, and creative play releases these self-healing archetypes. Primary to treatment is cooperation and possible treatment of the parents, especially if the problem is theirs. So we need to have close contact with the parents as we work with children. I think the younger the child, the more this is the case. When you get to adolescence, it's actually better not to work with the parents, because in adolescence, the child is looking more for having the therapist to himself, is becoming more individuated, separate from his parents. But real young children, like 2 or 3 years old, sometimes you work more with the parents than you do the child. And then as the child grows, matures, then it's different at various ages. So another what's primary to treatment is use of the therapist as a container and a transference object. You know, the child comes to the room with you, and the room is the container, the sand tray is the container, and the therapist helps to contain and hold the process so the child can express whatever they need to express, even very dark archetypal forces could be expressed in the sand, and the therapist or the analyst holds and contains that for the child until it's ready to be reintegrated in a more positive way. Creative equipment and tools for fantasy play are absolutely essential with children. They don't relate by talking. They need to play. And for you as a therapist to join them in the play. So they have their fantasy toys, drawing objects, clay, sand trays, everything that's needed, even for floor play. The child's process tends to go through chaos, struggle, resolution, chaos, struggle, resolution. You know, they go through that, like deintegration, reintegration. And as they move through these stages, there is a realignment of the ego-self axis. And then the psyche and behavior begin to operate more coherently together. Participation mystique issues need to be considered with the parents. At the time of Wicks and Neumann's, it was believed that, like I says, that this unconscious transference was the main thing that was important. And that's been changed, it's been refuted, but we still need to take that into consideration, that in some certain situations it does happen. Maybe the child's unconscious is actually affecting the parent's unconscious, and then the parent's unconscious is sabotaging anything to change after that. So, you know, we need to look at those unconscious forces that could be happening in the family system. Treatment should include, the parents need to be included in treatment, as I've said many times, and what you want to do when they call you for an initial session. I usually see the parents first and get a history and how they feel about the child and what they see the problem of the child, what they see as the problem. That's real important. And then I usually do diagnostic sessions, a whole series of them, like maybe 4 or 5. Of just the child. And during that time, I have them do drawings, a lot of diagnostic drawings, and I'll be talking about that in the class. Actually, the first class, we're going to be talking about the various different diagnostic drawings that you could use. You could also use sand play, and also the child's relationship with you and what the child talks about, says, expresses in their creative work. gives you a whole lot of good information that you can, you know, will help you in the treatment of the child. And as you treat the child, you want to continue relationship with the parents. See them once a month, or even more often, if you can, have them come in for a session, or once every other month, so you can continue that relationship with them. Oftentimes, when the child changes, the parent will they'll become uneasy about the change, because sometimes the child is actually the scapegoat in the family, or is acting out a particular problem in the family. And as that changes, as the child quits doing that, it creates tension in the family, because they need for the child to be that way. So then the parent will pull the child out. So if you see the parents on a regular basis, you can have that relationship with them, communicate with the parents what you see happening. You know, without being too revealing, you can show them how the change is happening, why it's changing, and then have them work on their issues, too, of what this change means to them. And that tends to keep them in this therapy, you know, without drawing them out quite so quickly. Sometimes the parents decide that they want to come in for therapy themselves. That happened quite often when I worked with children who were sexually abused. And I work with the child, and then later on, as I saw the mother periodically, decided that she needed to come in and work on her sexual abuse issues. Oftentimes, children are sexually abused when their parents haven't dealt with their issues yet. And then when you work with the child, with the parents, and they deal with their sexual abuse issues, then the child seems to get better. Sort of like what Jung was saying, you know, that the need to work with the parents to help the child, too. You may end up working with the couple. Maybe it's the parental relationship that's causing the problems for the child. Or sometimes you may have to work with the whole family together. So then there's the child-therapist relationship. Children's therapy and play is comparable to a hero's journey, one in which the hero conquers the dark and devouring forces within. And that's exactly what it is. They're conquering these forces that are very overpowering for them. The child reacts not so much to reality as a series of fantasies based on the archetypes. And from this, you interpret their play to them. And even their transference reactions to you. You interpret their transference reactions to you. Michael Fordham was real good in developing this the theory of the transference. Actually, Michael Fordham did know Dorokoff, and he did try Sample for a while, but it was not his style. He needed to engage with the child, and he thought that Sample was a bit too passive for him. He felt that the therapist needed to be more engaged with the child. Now, I think it could be done both ways, because sand play is the relationship between the child and the inner self, allowing the self to guide the healing process. But then sometimes the therapist needs to be involved too, you know, doing floor fantasy play or drawing, having the child make certain kind of books about themselves. You know, you want to engage the child in other ways, not just sand play. So what I'm really saying is that, like, passive therapy can, and that's what when a child's working in the sand and the therapist sits back, that's really passive therapy. Allowing that to happen and just engaging with the child when it seems, when the child essentially calls the therapist to do that. And that can really go so far, especially with children who have been abused. Because what they can do is end up getting stuck, actually get caught in what's referred to as stuck play. Ileana Gill talked about that quite often, is that they will keep doing the same thing over and over and over. you know, like boys who will do war scenes and war scenes. And this can go on week after week for years. And that's a form of stuck play. And sometimes a therapist does need to go in and kind of help unstick it by directing them to, you know, what if we do this? What if this guy wins here? What would happen? You know, not forcing it, but just suggesting it and seeing if anything could change. One example of this was a boy that I had worked with who had a problem with stuttering. And in one of the sessions, he created a sand tray where all the soldiers faced one direction. He didn't have anything that created that those soldiers were fighting. So I asked him, who are these soldiers fighting? And he said, well, they're fighting a wall, which, you know, you think is the image of stuttering in a way. And I thought, well, that was really appropriate. He says, well, maybe we could put a wall up there. So I happened to have a board, and I put a wall up there. And then we talked about what can we do to get this wall down. Well, he thought it would be really neat to make clay balls and throw balls at the wall. Well, we did that together, and we knocked the wall down. And this went on for 10 minutes, and we just had a wonderful time. Do you know his stuttering stopped for the rest of that session? Of course, it came back later on. There were other issues in his life, but it was very fascinating how his stuttering stopped when we did that. So as a child plays, sometimes you want to verbalize to the child what it is that you see happening in their sand play. So-and-so is angry at such-and-such, and you might get a yes from them. And they know that you've seen it, you've witnessed it, and you're supporting them in this process that's happening. And you want to encourage the child to talk about their feelings after they've played it out. You know, what were their feelings? And sometimes they come to you and they talk about their feelings first. You'll ask them to play out their feelings in the sand or in some drawing or in the floor play. Now, transference is a very significant issue in child therapy, and it really needs to be addressed. And if it's not addressed, sometimes the child won't go any further, especially if he has some real strong dark transference, negative transference onto you, and they will. They will project whatever archetype is big in their psyche on this helping professional, and you become that model. You know, they've projected it onto you, and they don't see you who you are. They just see this archetypal projection. Michael Fordham was real good about talking about that and how to work through it. He says what you ask yourself is, what is the nature of the child's feelings in the session? How is he reacting to me in the transference? Who have I become in his fantasy? And from this, you interpret the transference to the child. This can get tricky, you know, that we can get into Kleinian stuff. And, of course, Fordham was did learn a lot from Melanie Klein. I want to read you a little bit of what Fordham describes in a transference interaction with a child, a boy he was working with. He says, and this is in his article, Child Analysis, "My first impression was of a boy in whom the pressure of activity was such that he could not continue with one activity for more than a few minutes. This pressure was so great that I made a note to the effect that the child was like a hypomanic adult, his place corresponding to the flights of ideas in such an adult. In the midst of his activity, he would look apprehensively in my direction. I left him alone for a whole hour, merely acting in a friendly and helpful way when it seemed indicated. In this first interview, it seemed clear that he was afraid I was going to do something which he was terrified of. I accordingly told him, when the same symptoms manifested themselves at the second interview, that he was frightened of me, And that I knew that I knew doctors often did things to children which they, the children, did not ask to have done to them and which they could do nothing to prevent. The result was enthusiastic agreement. He told me how he hated doctors because they were always wanting to operate on him or stick things into him. I guess he had been going in for treatment quite regularly with doctors. Unless I had first cleared away this difficulty, I should have had to wait perhaps for weeks before he would have been able to establish sufficient positive feelings to proceed. As it was, his whole relation to me changed in a few minutes, and he gave me a large quantity of information. So, you know, he does it in a gentle, caring way by joining the child's fantasy and understanding the child. And that way the child feels understood, he feels heard, and then he can join you and know that you're not the bad guy anymore. So in conclusion, there are fundamental questions in treatment that have to be asked. Then everything else grows out of it. Number one, what is the particular fantasy system at work in the transference or in the child's play? How can the therapist help the child to understand what is going on? That's the second. Playing out the problem is only one aspect. The next step is to help it become conscious. Number three, how can he help the child to handle and transform, where necessary, those parts of himself which he feels to be bad? So that ends my talk for tonight. Characteristics. I think that's what Fordham sees in the infant observation, is that he sees personalities there. And I think we all know, you know, when we have children come to us at very, very young ages, you know, they all are very unique.
Yeah. And people come to him coming from the same family.
Yeah. Twins? No, I haven't. But you've seen that with twins, how different they could be too. Even identical twins, I guess, huh? Mm-hmm. Be interesting to see how they do sand play different. I bet it would be very similar, though. Maybe the same archetypes, same symbols, because of the familial pattern, but maybe they would use them differently, or, you know, be my guess, yeah.
You're talking about scum play. Mm-hmm. There's been different degrees of stuckness. I've been working with it for about 2 years. I'm just wondering, when do you just decide to pull it?
When you decide to what?
Just pull it on there, just stop there, because it's just...
Oh.
Because, I mean, your examples of interjecting new symbols and new ideas to help unstick the process, but I've tried things like that, too. It's just stuck.
Somewhere along the line, how long have you been working with the child? This is a child.
Yeah, about 2 years old. Sorry, 2 years.
2 years. Yeah, I think you just haven't quite gotten it.
Yeah.
I would never say and work with a child because they haven't gotten to it yet. But it sounds like it's frustrating.
Kinda.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you seeing someone for supervision?
Uh-huh.
And he or she's trying is giving you some pointers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, somewhere along the line, it's gonna happen. I think you just really need to be patient. You know, it's kind of like with adults. You know, with adults, look at all this stuff you got to get through before. At least with children, they haven't developed so much defenses. Well, you know, you can work for 10 years before you finally get to the essence of what you're wanting. And yeah, 2 years, maybe that isn't so long with children. How old's a child?
He's
about 6. Oh, yeah. Wow, yeah. Well, I'd say hang in there. You'll find it. He'll tell you. Do you do sand play?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. What's the picture of this
happening? It's
war.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's into war games, isn't he? That's developmental, huh? Yeah. Yeah, that's the fighting stage. Yeah, it can.
I went to work in New York for 3 years, and he's a twin, but not an identical twin. And he's just done all these bad things for me.
years. And now he's finally in Zen 3, and now the bridges are appearing, and the finding eyes are gone. I just thought it would never happen.
See, patience. You just have to hold and contain. When the psyche's ready, it's ready. We can't make it happen. We can kind of guide and direct, but if the psyche isn't ready, it's not ready. Yeah.
When is he trying to have self-control?
Do you want to explain, Susan?
Well, what I do, or what the kids do in my office, is to choose from a collection of small figures and a house and a castle and other things that are larger than what goes into the sand tray. But the idea is somewhat similar. The kids will set up sometimes simple, sometimes very complicated situations, and they'll either play alone and want me to watch, or they'll drag me into it and give me a role, and I have to say certain things. It's the other extreme, more or less. But it's with more space and a different armamentarium, a lot of soldiers for boys. And it's an opportunity for me. I use it. I tend to get pretty involved in the play if I have the opportunity.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.